on the types of restraint that they were using. So that is how we were able, is one of the few cities where we could actually count the times the hobble was used. And to their credit...
We have 15 seconds.
Okay, their credit, the police chief has denounced the practice and fired the officer who hobbled Shetea Kelly and left her in the well of a car for a drive down to the police station.
An astounding story, which you write about in your Marshall Project piece. He died like an animal. Some police departments hogtie people despite knowing the risks. We will link to it. Joe Neff, thanks so much for being with us. And also Flint Taylor, lawyer for Marcus Smith's family with the People's Law Office in Chicago. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
The Mediozillas! It's a bird! It's a plane! It's community radio!
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Multnomah County will move to the lower-risk COVID-19 category tomorrow. Police used toxic munitions yesterday as demonstrators gathered on the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder, and Amazon will buy MGM Studios in a massive $8.5 billion transaction. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, May 26th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Governor Kate Brown announced yesterday that Multnomah County will move to the lower risk category on Thursday. Four other counties that will also move to this category are Baker, Curry, Grant, and Tillamook. To qualify for the lower risk category, 65% of residents 16 and older must have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Moving to a lower risk allows counties to significantly reduce their COVID-19 restrictions, allowing a maximum of 50% capacity indoors at restaurants, theaters, gyms, and other indoor entertainment spaces. The Oregon Health Authority reported 424 new cases of COVID-19 on Thursday and 4 new deaths. There are currently 274 Oregonians hospitalized statewide. Oregon saw a 25% drop in reported coronavirus cases last week compared to the previous week. This marks the fourth straight week of COVID case numbers declining in the state. Nationally, the U.S. has reported over 33 million total cases of COVID-19. At least 590,000 people have died. In a milestone, the U.S. reported its lowest number of new COVID cases yesterday in over a year. Another milestone was reached today, with 50% of adults in the U.S. reported as being fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has infected more than 167 million people. At least 3.4 million people have died. The CDC is urging folks who aren't vaccinated to continue to mask up and follow other COVID protocols, including physical distancing. As COVID restrictions loosen, safety is urged on public transportation, even in states that have ended mask mandates. Here's Michaela Savitt with more on the story.
The CDC has determined that people 2 weeks out from receiving their last dose of the COVID-19 vaccine can interact with others without a mask on and without social distancing. However, COVID-safe behavior will have to continue on public transit, even in states like Florida that have ended mask mandates. Governor Ron DeSantis lifted the statewide mask mandate on May 3rd, but the TSA still requires masks at airports and on board airplanes. Tampa International Airport spokesperson Danny Valentine says the airport has workers who enforce the measure.
If they see someone without a mask on or wearing it improperly, They can either ask them to pull up their mask, cover their nose, or they can offer to give them a mask if they don't have one.
The CDC continues to advise that masks, when worn properly, are an effective way to prevent transmission of the virus, and that anyone over 2 years of age should wear them in public settings. Kids under 12 aren't yet approved to get the vaccine. Dr. Amit Arwindekar with United Healthcare Global says that age group doesn't usually see serious COVID symptoms, but can still spread the virus to others.
So if you're going to travel with children under the age of 12, we really encourage you to delay if you can. If not, make sure they wear their mask, make sure that they're washing their hands, and doing everything you can to keep them from getting sick so that they don't spread it to other people.
According to the latest CDC data, nearly 37% of Florida's population is fully vaccinated, and 5.3% of COVID tests were positive, a downward trend from the last few months. While COVID rules have relaxed for some activities, Arwindekar says things haven't returned to normal.
If you're taking public transit, if you're getting health care, or if you're in a tight space with other people, like say in an airplane, in a bus, in a car with people you don't live with, and it's important to still maintain those public safety measures, wearing your mask, washing your hands, distancing whenever possible.
He also urges careful planning for international trips, since the U.S. State Department has placed do not travel notices on 80% of countries. For Public News Service, I'm Michaela Savitt.
Demonstrators gathered in downtown Portland yesterday to commemorate the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder. The crowd grew to approximately 200 in front of the Justice Center, which houses Portland Police Bureau's Central Precinct and was the site of many protests in the summer of 2020. The two parks across the street, which were barraged by toxic munitions during that time, have been fenced off to encourage newly planted grass to grow. Some protesters dismantled the fences and lit a small dumpster fire, prompting the PPB to declare an unlawful assembly and later a riot and use tear gas and munitions against the crowd. According to a PPB press release, 5 individuals were arrested on criminal mischief charges, with some receiving additional riot and arson charges. A year after the murder of George Floyd, downtown Minneapolis commemorated his life and continued to push for fundamental policing change. For more, we go to Faven Gerezgeher with the Racial Reckoning Project.
On the anniversary of George Floyd's death, the community came out to commemorate his life and push for continued changes. In downtown Minneapolis, the George Floyd Memorial Foundation held a celebration with music, a community resource fair, and guest speakers from across the country. This is Dallas rapper Tony B. Recognizing my blackness kills, straight RP to my people's will. Drop the gun, hands up, don't shoot, little bro. Bianca Austin came here from Louisville. She said her family is still seeking justice for her niece, Breonna Taylor.
We need y'all more than ever right now, so we ask y'all to just keep standing, keep going. And in my message to George Floyd, we gonna make sure you rest in power, brother. We down here, we gonna make sure you rest in power. And I know
y'all not saying his name loud enough. What's his name?
There was a similar remembrance at George Floyd Square, the intersection residents and organizers have occupied for the past year. Anthony Galloway is a faith leader and co-host of Bearing Witness. He said community gatherings are a way to keep people activated.
We have to honor the things that have happened and be honest about them, right? And so we spent a year in trying to push and move things. This is part of that process. We got to also be commemorating, be in the practice of making sure that we don't lose the momentum. So I think it's about momentum. To be able to celebrate and show that we aren't going to go along with these things that hurt us.
Earlier in the day, preparations were interrupted by nearby gunshots. Despite the incident, hundreds gathered in honor of Floyd's life. Other celebrations and demonstrations for George Floyd were held across the country and world. For the Racial Reckoning Project, this is Faven Gerezgeher.
In a move that could affect hundreds of thousands of workers across the country, Montana has set off a wave of states ending federal unemployment benefits. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
Montana Governor Greg Gianforte's announcement in early May that the state would stop paying the higher pandemic-related federal unemployment benefits set off a domino effect as other states followed. Under the American Rescue Plan Act, states could increase jobless benefits by $300 per week through early September with federal funds. Montana also allowed folks to receive them past the usual 13-week cutoff. While unemployment numbers have gone down in Montana, Andrew Stettner with the Progressive Century Foundation says there are still too many barriers to jobs for people, such as lack of child care.
We are happy that the economy has recovered, but we don't return back to where we were overnight. And that's really what this is asking people to do when there's not really enough time for them to be able to do so.
The Century Foundation estimates the cutoff will affect more than 31,000 Montana workers, who now won't be getting some $154 million in federal funds. About half of U.S. states have followed Montana so far in cutting back benefits. Gianforte says it will address a labor shortage as the state opens back up. In place of benefits, the state is offering return-to-work bonuses of $1,200 through October and capped at 12,500 workers for people who complete 4 weeks of a new job. According to Stettner, bonuses are not a cost-effective way to get people back to work for the long term.
Wage subsidies, child care assistance, transportation assistance, people may need some help fixing their car or getting a new vehicle, for example. I'm all for those supportive services, but I think they should go alongside unemployment benefits as part of a transition out of the safety net.
Stettner says businesses also have a hand in enticing people back to work.
Who's having the trouble filling jobs? Well, they're jobs that don't have benefits. They don't have consistent hours. They aren't paying a living wage. Maybe employers can start looking in the mirror rather than blaming unemployed people for why people don't want to take their jobs.
The enhanced unemployment benefits are slated to end on June 27th in Montana. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
50% of American adults are now vaccinated, and many states are allowing fully vaccinated people to forgo masks and social distancing. With more on that story, here's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Today is about the remembrance of our brother George Floyd, father, uncle, friend.
Members of Floyd's family, including his brother Rodney Floyd, met with the president and vice president at the White House Tuesday on the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's death at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. Racial justice events were held around the country, including a celebration of life in Minneapolis. In Los Angeles, Black Lives Matter led a march. And on the East Coast, New York City officials knelt in silence for 9 minutes, 29 seconds, the same amount of time that Officer Derek Chauvin held his knee on Floyd's neck. The Reverend Al Sharpton joined the officials, calling Chauvin's conviction the beginning of the journey for justice.
We must have legislation that defines and refines what police excessive force is all about.
Floyd's family encouraged Congress to pass the George Floyd Policing Act. For the first time, a black woman will head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. The Senate confirmed Kristen Clark on Tuesday. At a Senate banking hearing, Democrat Sherrod Brown urged the Federal Reserve to address racism, arguing that, unlike big banks, communities of color have not benefited from the economy.
It's never looked all that great for the black and brown families who lost their homes and wealth in the wake of the Great Recession.
A Fed official rejected claims that rolled back banking restrictions contributed to racism. The U.S. met a major milestone in the fight against COVID-19, with now 50% of adult Americans fully vaccinated. The news comes after reports emerged that COVID-19 may have originated in Wuhan's Institute of Virology lab.
3 million people have died worldwide. We've disrupted the entire world's economy over a virus. If it came from a lab, we need to know it, and it needs to be fully investigated.
That's Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who's among those calling for an intensive investigation into the origins of the coronavirus. Senate Republicans will present another infrastructure counteroffer to the White House tomorrow. The GOP plans and President Joe Biden's proposal are roughly $1.5 trillion apart and define infrastructure differently. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he'll move the bill through the Senate in July with or without bipartisan support. Schumer's also among those condemning Georgia Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene for her comments comparing the COVID restrictions to the Holocaust.
She should stop this vile language immediately.
Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell didn't disagree.
This is one of the frequent outbursts that are absolutely outrageous and reprehensible.
Green recently was removed from her committee assignments for controversial comments she made prior to taking office. In New York, the Manhattan District Attorney has convened a grand jury that could decide on criminal charges against former President Donald Trump. Prosecutors are examining potential tax and bank-related fraud regarding Trump properties. Trump says the investigation is politically motivated. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
you are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, your daily source for COVID-19 updates hosted by infectious disease specialists. That will be followed at 5:45 by News from the Boo, your look inside KBOO, hosted by co-interim station manager Jenna Yokoyama. At 6, it's The Underground, then at 7, stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Tomorrow we can expect rain and a high of 62. Today in history, on this day in 2016, activist Hedy Epstein died at the age of 91. She was a German-born Jewish-American political activist and Holocaust survivor known for her support of Palestine through the International Solidarity Movement. She also supported the Black Lives Matter movement and was arrested in 2014 for failing to disperse during a protest in St. Louis over the killing of Michael Brown. The quote of the day is from author Elie Wiesel, a Holocaust survivor who wrote about his experiences at Auschwitz in his book Night. He said, quote, "I swore to never be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must always take sides." The Biden administration continues to send mixed signals on the U.S. government's reaction to Israel's actions against Palestine. The publication Jewish Currents reported yesterday that the U.S. State Department has granted Boeing an export license for the sale of advanced weaponry to the Israeli government, valued at around $735 million. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pledged $5.5 million in immediate emergency aid to help Gaza recover from the latest Israeli bombing campaign. Oxfam reported recently that over 20% of Gaza residents have no access to clean water. Israel continues to restrict Gaza in various ways, including cutting fuel supplies necessary for electricity generation and not letting Palestinian boats fish in the Mediterranean. Blinken also announced that the U.S. would reopen its consulate in Jerusalem, a move that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu objected to today. The announcement was made after a meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah, within the occupied West Bank. The consulate long served as an autonomous office in charge of diplomatic relations with Palestine, but former President Trump moved it to the purview of the U.S. ambassador to Israel, effectively downgrading its operations. The move to reopen the consulate is seen as an attempt to bolster U.S. relations with Palestine. The Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Lion may soon be wearing an Amazon smile, as Amazon is purchasing MGM for $8.5 billion. Amazon is expected to add MGM's film library, dating back to the studio's founding in 1924, and its TV programs to the Amazon Prime Video service, which over 200 million Amazon Prime members have access to. This is the second major media consolidation in 9 days, as AT&T and Discovery announced on May 17th that they would merge, combining CNN, HGTV, the Food Network, and HBO. The $8.5 billion price tag is Amazon's second largest purchase ever, after paying nearly $14 billion for Whole Foods in 2017. Tribal leaders in Arizona say new bills signed into law this year will disproportionately limit voting rights of Native voters. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. At least a dozen bills impacting voting in Arizona have been signed into law this year by the state's Republican governor, but tribal leaders say the measures will limit turnout in elections and disproportionately impact Native voters. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports.
GOP members of the state legislature say the bills are necessary to make Arizona's elections more efficient and secure. But two new laws signed by Republican Governor Doug Ducey have Navajo Nation officials worried that voting could become harder for tribal members, especially elders. One limits the amount of time voters have to add missing signatures to early ballots, and another purges inactive voters from Arizona's early voting list. Democratic State Representative and Navajo Nation tribal member Jasmine Blackwater Nigrin sees them as political retribution.
We saw the power of the Native American vote in this past election. We know that the Native American, specifically the Navajo population, came out very strongly in support of President Biden, and now we see their voting rights being attacked.
Blackwater Nigrin says because of the vastness and remoteness of the reservation, the new restrictions put added burdens on an already challenging process for many tribal communities. She and Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez call the new Arizona laws voter suppression. Another bill still under consideration by the legislature would require ID numbers and other documentation be sent with early ballots. Tribal leaders also oppose that measure. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Billings Police Department is investigating a report that a Northern Cheyenne Tribal Councilwoman was assaulted in Billings, Montana. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas has more.
The family of Silver Little Eagle published a Facebook statement last Thursday saying that on Sunday, May 16th, the Northern Cheyenne woman had been, quote, brutally attacked in Billings, Montana, and left for dead, end quote. In a statement Tuesday, the Billings Police Department confirmed the 24-year-old councilwoman was transported by ambulance from a hotel in downtown Billings to a local medical facility to treat her injuries. The statement went on to say Little Eagle's vehicle had been located several blocks away from the hotel, and another unidentified 31-year-old male was reported to have been assaulted in the same location as Little Eagle. BPD says detectives with the investigations unit are actively working the case and that two persons of interest have been identified and are being sought for questioning. Police do not think this is a random act of violence, a racially motivated crime, or a crime connected to human trafficking. The department says it's believed everyone involved knew each other in some way. BPD said they typically do not identify victims, but the case has become public since Little Eagle is a political representative and her family spoke about the case online. A statement from her family said Little Eagle has received further threats of violence and cyberbullying since the incident. A GoFundMe campaign organized to cover Little Eagle's medical and legal expenses has surpassed its $25,000 goal. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
U.S. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh met with Ho-Chunk Nation officials Tuesday at their tribal headquarters in Wisconsin. The visit was part of a tour the secretary made in the state. Tribal leaders say Walsh committed to working on relationships with tribes, a pledge made by President Biden and directed to his cabinet. Walsh also met with Ho-Chunk Department of Labor staff. Ho-Chunk Nation President Marlon White Eagle says the visit established connections and will help with future interactions with the federal agency. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is examining the impact the pandemic has had on Native languages. An oversight and legislative hearing is being held Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Witnesses from Alaska, Hawaii, Oklahoma, and Minnesota are expected to testify. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Investigators of Sunday's cable car accident in northern Italy have found that the car's emergency brake system had been tampered with. The cable car was carrying passengers to the top of the Mottarone Mountain, a popular attraction just over 50 miles northwest of Milan. If the emergency brakes had been operating properly, the cable car should not have plummeted to the ground, killing 14 of the 15 passengers aboard. Three people, including the owner of the firm that manages the aerial tramway, were arrested on charge of suspected involuntary manslaughter and negligence. Public prosecutor Olympia Bossi said the three are alleged to have made, quote, a conscious gesture by tampering with the emergency brakes in order to avoid disruptions to the cable car service. The cable car had shown anomalies since resuming service in late April. The lone survivor, a 5-year-old boy whose parents, great-grandparents, and younger siblings died in the crash, is still in critical condition, but has opened his eyes and is recovering from anesthesia. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael worries that truth may no longer be enough.
More and more, it's a world of lies, not laws. Belarus forces a commercial jet to land there with a lie about a bomb in order to arrest a dissident journalist who later appears on TV lying about how well he's been treated despite facial bruises and missing teeth. And if you can't lie, deny January 6th at the Capitol was just some rowdy tourist. Israel's only defending itself. Seems that when someone settles the score, the game often goes into extra innings. At times you do get honesty, like the Texas legislature reducing polling places in blue and POC districts while increasing polls in some red districts, and this will be law. That 6 of 10 Republicans still believe Trump's election lie makes me even more worried about the power of money and media to distort reality and make us fear those we have the most in common with while trusting those who, if they see us at all, see us as easily replaceable parts. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The country of Denmark is planning to build a massive wind energy hub on an artificial island. The project is expected to eventually produce enough electricity for 10 million European households. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The country of Denmark has long produced oil and gas in the North Sea, but Denmark has pledged to phase that out by 2050.
Instead, we are raising our ambitions when it comes to offshore wind.
Dan Jorgensen is Denmark's Minister of Climate, Energy, and Utilities. He says that over the next decade, his country plans to build a massive wind energy hub on an artificial island in the North Sea. It will collect energy from hundreds of offshore wind turbines and deliver it to European customers. In its first phase, the hub is expected to produce enough electricity to power 3 million households, and ultimately enough for 10 million.
So it's a huge project. It's probably the biggest infrastructure project in the history of my country.
Jorgensen says abundant clean energy can help advance other green technologies. Denmark's long-term goal is to use wind power to create liquid fuel for use in planes and ships.
That technology exists today, but it's very expensive and it's not possible to do it in the scale that would be necessary. So that's one of the reasons why we are doing this.
So long-term, the project could create winds of change for green transportation, too. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, May 26, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, the producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Favin Gerezgeher, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Michaela Savitt, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tagadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 9, it's Fortress on a Hill, and tomorrow, join 3 U.S. veterans as they discuss how to turn the tide against endless war and repair the damage the U.S. has caused abroad. Then stick around at 10, we'll have Flashpoints, Investigative News Journalism with Dennis Bernstein. All of those KBOO programs, and including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today, so let's go ahead and get started. The vaccine photo op has a long history. As Americans began getting vaccinated for COVID-19, the jabs brought along a new social media phenomenon, the vaccine selfie. You've likely seen it on your feed from your friends or from celebrities, arm out, medical worker preparing to administer the dose. Now, according to the New York Times, while the ubiquitous nature of the images is a new phenomenon, the vaccine photo op has had a long precedent in America. Even in the late 1700s, there were engravings of Edward Jenner, the creator of the smallpox vaccine, vaccinating his children. In the 1950s, Elvis Presley got his polio vaccine on the set of the Ed Sullivan Show, and multiple presidents have had their own vaccine photo ops. The images have always had a similar intention. Seeing trusted cultural figures getting inoculated could promote faith in their safety and subtly compel the public to follow suit. This model fell apart when COVID came along, however, because according to the Times, there's two reasons for this. First, because social media platforms were more widely used. And second, because many Americans have lost trust in major leaders in science. This means that even though it was important to see prominent figures getting the COVID vaccine, it's even more important to see wide representation of people being vaccinated to ensure that everyone can relate to what they're saying. And while they may cause some envy, the vaccine selfie is doing important work in the quest for herd immunity. Transgender people who transitioned in the pandemic now have to go back to the office. The pandemic lockdown gives us all time to sit with ourselves and internally reflect on what was important to us. For some, a desire for the reflection in the mirror to match the person inside was most important. So the USA Today heard stories from transgender individuals who used the downtime of the pandemic to transition. It was a unique time of being at home and away from the office that gave some people the courage to move forward. While most spoke of their experience with transitioning during the pandemic positively, some also spoke of downsides, such as not being able to connect as easily with a supportive social network, difficulties with getting doctor's appointments, and not being able to do name changes because the courts were closed. In addition, those who experimented with gender identity behind masks and computer screens during the pandemic may soon have to return to the workplace as vaccination distribution ramps up and businesses reopen. But the question is, will workplaces be ready to provide a tolerant and safe environment for employees who now identify differently than before? The answer is hopefully yes. Advocates say that in recent years, businesses have generally emerged as champions of transgender equity when federal policies and state laws seemingly aim to erode their civil rights. So in conclusion, one silver lining of the pandemic is that it has allowed some individuals the time and opportunity to express themselves however they see fit. The geopolitics of pandemics. According to The New Yorker, war, migration, and environmental and political changes have been causing a rise in infectious diseases even before the pandemic, and have naturally exacerbated the COVID crisis in many countries and regions. Wars have a long history of worsening pandemics, most notably in the spread of influenza during World War I, but also in typhus epidemics during World War II. Armed conflict generally destabilized poor regions in the nations involved, weakening health infrastructure by causing malnutrition and sanitation problems. Nations such as Syria and Iraq, mired in civil war, have seen measles and polio resurgence even before the COVID pandemic. In Syria now, COVID has brought the nation to near starvation. General political instability has also led to similar public health results. Venezuela, which has suffered a major economic and political crisis, saw its healthcare system collapse over the past few years, and this led to a reemergence of measles. Venezuela has also seen a lot of immigration, along with war-torn countries across the globe. Refugees typically lack nutrition and healthcare, and camps are often ripe for spreading the disease. In low-income nations in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, urbanization is happening rapidly. According to The New Yorker, researchers are concerned that those densely packed megacities could be bad for public health and sanitation, with limited access to clean water and food insecurity. Another major casualty of development may be climate change's effect on health infrastructure. The Middle East has seen increased droughts that have created massive competition for water and overcrowding rural areas, and rising temperatures shift ecosystems for insects that spread disease. a major ideological threat to the future of infectious diseases, according to the magazine, is nationalist and anti-science rhetoric. This has been particularly resonant during COVID-19's major vaccine hesitancy. The lack of online infrastructure to prevent all systems and avenues for medical misinformation may doom the public to repeat this. Anti-vaccine camps have also grown in political power, joining up with many populist movements in the U.S. and abroad. It is important to look to history and the present crisis in order to understand what the world must do to evade the next major health catastrophe. According to The New Yorker, the world must commit resources to pressuring online platforms to manage misinformation and to distribute health resources evenly in order to avoid repeating history. The unsung heroes, custodians. All right, I know I'm going to love this story. Now, throughout the pandemic, frontline workers have been applauded for their selfless work and dedication to keeping the public safe and healthy. Some rather overlooked and underappreciated heroes of the pandemic are custodians and cleaning staff. Early mornings, long days, well into the night, custodians have been tasked with thoroughly cleansing and disinfecting public spaces to better mitigate what was once considered the risk of COVID-19 and community transmission. Now, though custodial work has been deemed essential during the pandemic, at times they have not received the same protections and added protections that other essential workers, such as healthcare workers, have received. In the beginning of the pandemic, there were several uncontrolled outbreaks, particularly due to community spread in public spaces. Many custodians feared having to go out to work as the spread unraveled before them. In this time, several custodial staff did not yet have the tools and resources to protect themselves while working. Now, fortunately, now, more than a year into the pandemic, most custodial staff have new equipment and better protocols for cleaning while also maintaining their health and safety. It continues to be an uphill battle for custodians working in public spaces, as maintaining clean surfaces and spaces is a challenge with the constant circulation of people entering and exiting. Nevertheless, custodians keep working diligently to disinfect surfaces and spaces as frequently as possible so as to keep everybody safe. One university custodian explained, "You may not have seen us before the pandemic, but I guarantee you, you'll see us now." And with this sentiment in mind, it's important to thank your custodians and show them deserved appreciation for the work they do to keep you safe. We have a history of overlooking and underappreciating the work of custodial staff. Now more than ever, they should be recognized for their dedication and commitment to making our public spaces safe. And to that, I say, yes, indeed. And here at COVID Noise Filter, we tip our hat to the custodians. Whales are happier in the pandemic. While it's been over a year since the pandemic began, on this podcast, we talked about how the pandemic has negatively affected us all. However, there are some of us who have benefited from the slower pace and distancing that came from pandemic, and that's whales. Now, according to ABC News, in countries where whale watching is a popular tourist attraction, visitor numbers have gone way down due to the coronavirus pandemic. However, the global decrease in visitors has actually been good for the whales, as human interference has decreased. This has meant that ambient noise in the world's oceans from cruise ships, sonar, and construction is much lower than pre-pandemic times. Ari Freelander, marine ecologist and biologist with the University of California at Santa Cruz, which, by the way, is my alma mater, has been studying how the quieter oceans has affected whales by measuring their stress levels through hormone samples. As whales use songs to communicate with one another and to locate food, noise in the environment can interfere with these communications and other critical life functions, causing higher stress levels. He anticipates with decreased human activity and noise in their environment, the stress levels will go down. In Iceland, an added benefit of the pandemic for the whales is that it helped to accelerate the end of commercial whale hunting. Because social distancing restrictions didn't allow for people to be on boats, whaling companies had to stop operating. Two companies have vowed never to hunt whales again. This is partly because the demand for whale meat has continued to drop. One whale watching boat captain said, "People have stopped eating whale meat for several reasons, including realizing the senselessness of killing an animal that can live for almost a century." This is a prime example that there's always light at the end of the tunnel. And as we work to end this pandemic, the whale population is being allowed to flourish once again. This is another beautiful silver lining of our pandemic. Remote learning allows teens to sleep in. School times for middle and high school students have been a subject of debate for many years now. Now the CDC recommends that teenagers get 8 to 10 hours of sleep a night, and early start times may impede that, leaving some students to be sleep deprived. As we've seen, the pandemic moved most schooling online and eliminated commutes for many students. And according to the Washington Post, this created somewhat of a natural experiment that scientists might be able to leverage in suggesting that schools shouldn't start earlier than 8:30. The results so far have been anecdotal due to the additional variables of the pandemic, but firsthand accounts may offer an idea of what later start times would look like for young people. One middle schooler said that on earlier start days, he felt attached and had difficulty engaging and found that he did better work on the later days. One principal reported similar results in his students. Delaying classes just by an hour provided more excited and engaged learners. Some students, on the other hand, haven't seen a positive change. This may be because the pandemic may also seem to increase in stress and anxiety, which for many can impede sleep. Although the results are mixed and inconclusive, these glimmer of positive change for young people should be heeded. Students are concerned that adolescents are suffering from severe sleep deprivation, which can contribute to long-term issues such as heart disease and mood disorders. Pandemic pushes people outdoors. The pandemic has shifted our former realities into new ones. Many have discovered the beauty of being outdoors in the face of social isolation. You may have noticed more people hitting the trails or taking on the town via bicycle across the globe. Outdoor activities have largely increased, and many companies are hoping this level of activity continues after the pandemic. Nick Hage, the general manager of Cannondale and GD Bicycles, explained this global pandemic caused people globally to change their behaviors, which has led to a global bike boom. In the U.S., sales increased by 65% in 2020. Electric bike sales increased by 145%. Additionally, golf equipment went up 10% in the month of January, and camper sales climbed by 40%. Another popular activity is boating. Similarly, boat sales and boating equipment have surpassed previous sales as more people get out of the house and head outside. Boaters highlighted the intense need to escape the constraints of being isolated from normal life. Nature and the great outdoors provide people with an outlet to escape such intense isolation. When the pandemic first began, there were more questions than there were answers, and many people didn't know where to turn. A simple and easy option was to pass the time outside before the pandemic were more limited for much of the population. Today, there's been a rejuvenation and a deeper appreciation for the natural world around us. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Hi, I'm Erica Thomas, producer of Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly show where youth interview Portland artists about how they do their work and make a living. As a believer in youth-powered media, we ask that you show your support for KBOO's youth programs. When you donate to KBOO for Youth Day, your donation will go directly to support KBOO's youth programming, allowing KBOO to continue providing unique opportunities in radio for young producers and volunteers looking to amplify voices from their communities. Donate to KBOO today at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321. Help us empower another generation of independent radio makers.
Get KBOO'd up because it's KBOO time! KBOO time! Get KBOO'd up! Get KBOO'd up because it's KBOO time! KBOO time!
Hi, I'm Chance and I'm a member of KBOO's Youth Collective. I think my life's changed in the most important way from going to KBOO's because I finally actually found my passion for public policy and learning about these complex issues. And that's why I'm going to be studying sociology at PSU this fall. If you're interested in joining KBOO Youth Collective, email us at volunteer@kboo.org or show your support for KBOO's youth programming by donating to KBOO today by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321.